Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. Today we're going to be featuring an encore presentation of a great interview I did with the singer-songwriter Justin Townsend. I spoke to him in 2019, the year before his tragic death, and I think the interview captures a lot of what made him incredibly special. So here's that. In the meantime, again, Happy New Year, and we'll see you next week with a brand new episode. Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. I'm in the studio with one of the best young songwriters, youngish songwriters in America, Justin Townsend, who has a beautiful new album called The Saint of Lost Causes. And welcome, man.
Hey, thanks for having me.
How do you feel age-wise? Are you feeling young, or are you feeling young-ish, or are you feeling older than your years?
I've been on this earth too long. You know, it's been a long, rough life, but I mean, that just happens. I mean, but you don't get to write songs the way that I write songs if you don't, you know, live.
But you've talked about that being a little bit of a trap too, that idea, right? I mean, it could be dangerous thinking that you got to live to provide grist for the art.
Well, it is. It's like, well, no, what I'm saying is you don't got to shoot speedballs to be able to write songs. You don't got to be all fucked up to write songs. I know songwriters like Joe Pug. You know, and I always call him, he's like such a nice guy. And he's like, you know, college educated, not a drunkard. He can write a great song. So it's not a prerequisite. But one thing you have to do is take your earbuds out, get your head out of your goddamn iPhone, and pay attention to what's going on around you, the world around you. Because otherwise, you're going to write diary entries. And nobody wants to hear your diary entries.
That's always come natural to that, observing the world. Does it become more of a challenge as your life goes on and the world gets more full of distractions?
Well, I do think that it does get harder to find interesting things to write about amongst the public, because I think that we're, you know, it's just the way that it is right now. I mean, not just America, but the world is in a fucked up state right now. A lot of bad shit going on that you really have to process what you, I mean, like, I was sitting in a Waffle House at one time, and I heard this guy behind me tell this girlfriend, go, "Look, woman, if you ain't glad I'm leaving, you ought to be." And I was like, ooh, and I wrote, "Ain't glad I'm leaving."
Whoa.
Right after that. So, you know, it's things like that. I mean, nowadays we have to be, it's treacherous. This world is, it's hard now.
It's weird. I mean, I once happened to sit next to your dad at a Bruce Springsteen concert like 3 years ago. I didn't realize it was him till like halfway through. In fact, I kind of grumbled at him because his phone was too bright and it was in that dark concert. You know, it's classic old dude stuff. But while Bruce was playing a song, I just happened to see Steve pulled out his iPhone and started, he clearly had been struck by inspiration, started writing lyrics right there. So
yeah. I mean, I've always been a cocktail napkin writer. My dad's the same way. It's just like, it's not sitting down at a desk and like, I gotta finish this song today. It can take me 6 months to write a song, because I mean, if you stole one of my notepads, you could get a whole steno pad that just has one song in it, over and over and over again, edited, going over and over and over again. But you know, that's patient about writing songs, but knowing that if you want to be a songwriter, you need to be a songwriter and nothing else matters.
There's a lot of approaches, but just to put it on polar ends, there's the Leonard Cohen type approach, which is revise, revise, revise. There's the Neil Young approach, which is basically like first draft, best draft. You've always been on the Leonard Cohen side, I guess.
Yeah, I've always been you know, most people who think that their first guess is the right guess, you need to keep that to, you know, shooting pool, not life and not art. Because it's, you know, you're probably wrong. You'll probably find something different. I mean, you'll probably think of something better later if you give it time to rest and you're within you.
On your new album and on, you know, basically your whole catalog, you're drawing on a really wide range of roots music, which kind of includes, stretches all the way to like Springsteen and the Replacements and all the way back to Woody Guthrie and maybe before old bluesmen and stuff. But do you ever feel a little bit like one of the Last Jedi kind of things? Because the tradition is a little bit withering on the vine to a certain extent in the larger culture.
I do think that it is withering. Kurt Cobain was not a great songwriter because the first thing that he heard was Thin Lizzy, and he based everything off Thin Lizzy or Springsteen. He was a great songwriter because he went all the way back to Lead Belly. He understood Woody Guthrie. He understood Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee. Songwriting is such a history. If you get to do this for a living, you owe something to the past. you know, and you got to be ballsy to step up and write a song like They Killed John Henry or Same Old Stag O' Lee. But it is your responsibility to carry on those traditions if you're going to use them.
Up Chestnut Hill, down on Murfreesboro Pike.
Set up on. But yeah, even in, you know, certainly not in country music, not a ton in anywhere are there people.
No.
So how do you feel about that?
It's awful. All that bro country bullshit that's coming out of Nashville now. I mean, even hip hop drives me insane now. I mean, what happened to flow?
Yeah.
You know, now it's like. But, you know, this happens to all forms of music. I mean, if you sat next to Howlin' Wolf right now and asked him what he thought about the state of the blues, he'd say, ain't no blues.
Right.
He wouldn't be happy about it. You ever heard his quote about Eric Clapton? Where he was asked, I think it was in Mojo magazine, they said, what do you think about all these British blues prodigies? He goes, British blues prodigies? Like, who? They go, like Eric Clapton. And he goes, I tell you what Eric Clapton can do is he can take that wee-wah pedal and throw it in the creek on his way down to the barbershop.
I never heard that one.
Wee-wah pedal.
You reach out kind of externally, I think, as much as you ever have on almost every song on this album. It's really very little that's autobiographical, other than maybe the last track, Talking to Myself.
I'll admit I'm lonely, need someone to hold me just to sleep at night.
This is definitely my most outward-looking record. You know, I was processing a lot of stuff that, and it takes me years to process things. Like, people ask me, have you wrote a song about your daughter? I was like, she's only two. Maybe when she's five, I'll process it enough to get something about it. You know, but I wanted to take what Springsteen did for New Jersey and spread it around America. So, Ay Esta Mi Niña, I'm at a Puerto Rican guy from the Alphabets who got locked up on mandatory minimums, and he's just off the bus from Clinton Correctional, and they put him out on the Bowery, and he runs into his daughter for the first time as a teenager. Over Alameda is about a kid from the Jordan Downs housing projects in South Central Los Angeles. Flint City Shake It, Appalachian Night, all that stuff. You know, it's like spread it around because I think we've forgotten that we're Americans. We're all Americans.
The Appalachian Nightmare is like the level of detail in that. I can think of a few other, yeah, examples of that besides, like, Springsteen stuff. Yeah. Maybe you can. I was wondering if there's any other models for that level of storytelling detail in a song.
Smoking, drinking, by age 13, skipping class and getting high.
That was a hard song to write because it was a lot of detail, and I'll probably never play it live because I'll never be able to remember all those damn words.
You got to use the prompter like Bruce.
No, never. But that's the thing that we have to remember is, like, you know, it's like you think about, like, for so long people were like, oh, you know, big drug problems. Well, that's a black people problem and a Mexican problem and a, you know, da 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 da, all this. But you know what? Go to Appalachia and say, if you marginalize anybody, they will respond. They will respond. They're going to do what they got to do to survive. So in Appalachia, they robbed the hell out of drugstores and they cooked the hell out of meth. And it's ruined Appalachia. The same thing that ruined South Central Los Angeles. The same thing that ruined South Nashville.
There's a degree of parallel to the guy's story in that song to your own life, obviously.
A bit, yeah. I lived in Appalachia. I lived in Johnson City, Tennessee for a little while. Pogie, Tennessee. Butler, Tennessee for a little while, which is, you know, right on the border of North Carolina and Virginia. And yeah, it was ate up with pharmaceuticals in the 90s. I mean, long before people started worrying about, oh, you know, now they're trying to sue drug companies because people are addicted to Oxycontin. It's like, you know, drug company's problem. It's our problem.
Well, I mean, it does sound like they were pushing doctors to prescribe and all that kind of thing.
Well, I mean, they got something to sell, don't they? They got something to sell, but it ain't a drug company's problem that somebody started taking pills. You know what the problem is? It's something hurt inside them. Something wasn't right inside them. And the world didn't treat them right. They never felt comfortable. And they found something that made them comfortable. I mean, I remember the first time I shot heroin, I was 12 years old. And nothing had ever felt right in my life. But when that plunger went down, I mean, it was like a warm blanket wrapped over me. And everything was okay. It got un-okay really fast. You know, that first time, that's the bitch. But we do have to realize this, that it's not, people who have drug problems are missing something inside them.
Yeah. I mean, I've talked to a lot of people who lived hardcore lives and then became dads or moms, and it tends to start to give you new perspective, especially as your kid gets older. You still have just a little kid, but are you already starting to flip perspectives a little bit and see, like, geez, what the hell is going on that I got that bad? I was 12 years old.
Well, you know, no. Nothing will ever change the heart that's inside of me. And, you know, he goes way deeper than my father. I was a kid. I was abandoned. I was molested. I was beaten.
Jesus.
You know, so everybody's lucky I'm not a serial killer. I mean, and so there's something that will always be missing inside of me. But I will protect my daughter. I will protect my daughter and make sure that does not happen to her. I do the best I can to do that. I hope she has a better life than I did.
Yeah. Well, your life's not over yet, you know what I mean? Like, it's like you're still writing the story.
Yeah, you know, it's still going. It's still going, and I mean, well, I hope she has a better youth than I did. That's the thing.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
There seems like a degree of like a journey of self-repair that you're on to a certain extent. How much of it is in therapy and stuff? Because I know you told me last time we spoke that, you know, you've talked to a few head shrinkers, you said, but how much is through like your art? Or is that like too romantic to imagine that's a healing thing?
Well, I mean, it's definitely what I do, like writing songs and performing is, if I didn't do that, I mean, I would be insane. Not to mention it's, you know, the only way I know how to make money other than selling dope.
Mm.
You know, so if I didn't do this, then I'd be in prison or dead right now. And so there's something very therapeutic about it. I love being on stage. I love writing songs, all those things. But once again, it's not, you can't write songs that are diary entries.
Yeah.
You know, you can't do diary entries. Nobody wants to hear that. Even Mama's Eyes, like songs like that, that's not a diary entry. I left a lot open for what other people want to think.
Yeah, those two songs, Mama's Eyes and Farther Away From Me, are like from two really powerful albums that are paired in the same way. But, I mean, those are pretty defining songs about, like, your a sort of essential dilemma on some level. And it also feels like after those two albums paved the way for something like this where you're reaching more outside yourself.
Yeah, well, no, I think that I had to write those songs. I wouldn't have been able to put them on my first record. Those songs needed to be later because I needed to grow up to be able to a little bit to write those songs. And yeah, I had to process a lot of things within me and also grow up and quit being so self-centered as a you know, I mean, it's like I'm a songwriter. I'm arrogant as hell. You know, and so I start looking around me and realizing that, you know, yeah, I hurt, but there's a lot of people who hurt worse.
Mama's Eyes is, you know, just to set it up for people, is essentially a song about seeing your mother in you and seeing that as a redemption from whatever you don't like about maybe what you inherited from your dad, if I maybe oversummarize.
Yeah, no, it is. It's absolutely like, you know, it's the idea of somebody who's, they're exactly like their father, which was the last thing they wanted to be. Not saying that they wanted to do for a living, but as a person, you didn't want to end up doing all the things that your daddy did. And you did. And your last saving grace is everything about you is like your father, except for one night, very depressed, you light a cigarette and you see in the mirror and your eyes are shaped like your mother's. And that's the only thing you got that you feel is redeeming.
And let's hear that for a minute.
That's 3 a.m. and I'm standing in the kitchen. I'm holding my last cigarette.
And then let's just talk about that other song, Farther From Me, which, man, I mean, so have you ever sat down and actually discussed what's in that song with your actual dad?
No, no, we don't really talk about this. You know, I think the going back to Mama's Eyes, the first time he heard Mama's Eyes was he was standing like the proud father on the edge of the Ryman Auditorium stage when I think it was opening for Old Crow Medicine Show or something like that years ago. And I played it solo. And I remember walking off stage and he goes, yeah, Mama's Eyes, that's a good song, man.
I think probably what's most brutal about Farther for me is when you put yourself in his shoes and you're like so many nights all alone, coast to coast, haunted by the ghosts of a child's hopes. It's like, yeah. I mean, that's fucking brutal, man. No,
I haven't actually thought about that song in a while, but yeah, coast to coast, haunted by the ghosts of a child's hopes. And I mean, it's
so many nights, so all alone.
I've always been brutally honest with my songs. I mean, nobody can tell me that I'm not honest in my writing. You know, nobody's going to say that I wrote about bullshit.
There's two songs about Flint, Michigan on this record, on the new record, besides the outrage that everyone kind of shares. What led you in that direction?
Well, the same, what I was talking about earlier about marginalizing people. And this is the thing. It's like, yeah, you can take that back to Roger Smith and GMC when he took GMC and moved all the factories out of Flint, moved them out of Detroit. But you know what? It's like people who blame politicians for things. It's like, if you blame a politician for something, we let it happen. We let it happen. Americans. But if people in Flint, Michigan, South Central Los Angeles, Appalachia knew how much they had in common, I think we could get things together a little bit better. But we have to realize that we let things happen. And we can't say they. You know, I'm on the left. Well, and they're on the right. No, no. We. Americans. I don't care what side you're on. We're Americans.
Your sound is varied from record to record, but there's still like an aesthetic that I associate with you. One of the things is like stand-up bass and just a certain size and a certain soundscape to the recordings. And you've obviously worked as a producer yourself. You co-produced this record. Like, how would you describe the kind of production that you like, that you want to make for these songs?
Well, you know, each record is different. Each song is different. But I had the grace of being born a Southerner. And one thing that we have is every form of popular music, American music, was created in the South. Bluegrass, country, jazz, blues, and then it all heads up to Memphis and becomes rock and roll. Mm. So what that gives us is, if you pay attention, you have the chance to really know, get into the roots of all those kinds of music and understand them from their base. If you don't pay attention, then you're stupid, you know, as far as I'm concerned. But it does, it gives you this thing where you feel these, we know how it grooves. I mean, it's just something that feels right about it. It's all those kinds of music. We created them. And I say Southerners, and that means black, white, Creole, whatever you want to be. It's a Southerner. We're just Southern Americans. It's ground zero.
How important was Tom Waits to just formation of your style?
Tom Waits was very important because I loved the way that his ability, his imagery. I remember that song, Hang Down Your Head, off Rang Dogs, where he says, hush your wild violin, hush your band of gold, hush your inner story, I've heard somebody told. Wild violin, hush your band of gold. That is simple and so beautiful, but at the same time, he'll have a line where it says, meet me by the knuckles of the skinny bone tree. Yeah. Like, what in the fuck. I mean, it's like, and you know, his wife is his co-writer on a lot of his stuff. And so their brains together are something else, you know, it works. I mean, even his early stuff, like, you know, it's, well, it's fast women and slow horses and unreliable sources. And now I'm holding up this lamppost if you want to know. That's great.
Yeah.
And even, what was that song? Someone got a side on the back street, say Slacko got a brand new slack, and your baby's handcuffed on the back seat, said, sit right there, boy, you relax. And he has a line in that same song, half pint of festival brandy, Sacco drink a whiskey in church.
Jesus.
It's insane.
Which other artists have you, like, kind of absorbed every lyric to that extent that you can rattle them off? Like, who else is in the absolute top of the pantheon for you?
Springsteen and Malcolm Holcomb. Very important. I mean, one of the most important songs to me. I think it's one of the most perfect songs ever written, and not the original recording. I don't like the original recording of Thunder Road. I don't, but there is on
too
that,
grandiose for you?
There was just something about it, like, I mean, I liked it, but I get this the live 1975 to 85 box set. The first part of it is a version of Thunder Road with just Danny Federici playing piano and Springsteen singing and playing harmonica, and it's slow.
Yeah.
And it changed it to where, you know, those lines like a screen door slams and Mary's dress waves, like a vision she dances across the porch as the radio plays. Those are some lines. I mean, it's some serious, your ghosts in the eyes of all the boys you sent away. They haunt this dusty beach road in the skeleton frames of burned out Chevrolets. Door slams,
Mary's dress waves. Like a vision she dances.
Can't really top that, no.
No, I think it is one of the most perfect songs written. But Malcolm Holcomb was very influential. Shane McGowan was very influential for me for the same reason, the way that he, you know, his imagery, like a pair of brown eyes, you know, that opening line, "One summer evening, drunk to hell, I sat there nearly lifeless when an old man in the corner sang where the water lilies grow." I mean, that is fucking amazing. But Malcolm had this simplicity about him. He's one of the most electrifying performers I've ever seen play solo acoustic. But he has this song called "Who Carried You?"
Mm.
The opening line, "From a Cajun diner to Carolina, sick in the morning, see the town doctor. Life in Agatha Christie on a trailways back to New Orleans. Who done it? Who carried you?
From a Cajun diner to Carolina, sick in the morning, see the town doctor."
He's more in the underrated category. People
way,
sleep on him, yeah.
Way underrated. I mean, he was a nightmare for a while. I mean, it was insane. I've been at shows with Malcolm back in the day where the doorman wouldn't let him in because he thought he was homeless. He's like, no, dude, that's the guy playing. Yeah.
It's funny, you toured with Lily Hyatt, which is like a little on the nose in a way. Do you think that there's, love it or hate it, is there some genetic component to like songwriting talent?
No,
really?
I don't, because I mean, there's plenty of sons and daughters of that are the shittiest songwriters you've ever seen in your life. Most of them are,
uh-huh.
Because they're trying to live up to something, and they sound too much like their parents. One thing I love about Lily is, even growing up with her dad, like, I mean, she has a sound like nothing else. These weird cadences,
she's great,
wild.
Yeah.
I mean, good lyrics. You know, it's like we didn't ride our daddy's coattails into this business. We created something for ourselves. Our daddies can't do what we do. We can't do what our daddies do.
Mm. Is it an irritating assumption that, I don't think anyone thinks you rode the coattails, but that, oh man, well, you were just born to it, man. Like, look who your dad is. Like, the town was in you.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, it was in me. I met him when I was probably like 14 or something, like, for most part. I mean, we knew, of course, I saw him as I was young, but really got to know him when I was like fucking to like 12 or so, somewhere around there. I grew up with my mother in a shitty rundown apartment on food stamps. You know what makes the best grilled cheese sandwich in the world? Government cheese, gonna be like brown box. Woo, best grilled cheese you ever had.
Right, that was your life. Yeah.
You know, so like people are like, oh, it was like growing up, and you with your. I was like, I didn't grow up with my dad. I grew up with my mama. That's why I wrote "Mama's Eyes," not "Daddy's Eyes."
Did he really fire you from his band at one point?
Yeah. I caused $10,000 worth of damage to a hotel room in Berlin, and then.
What was the nature of the damage?
Shut up. It's actually pretty funny. I'm still banned from Millennium Hotels worldwide. Because I was junked out back then, and I was like, we were in Berlin, and I got on the train like outside our hotel and went up to this spot where I knew to cop dope, got high, and got off at the wrong stop coming back. And when I got out, I was on this open air market. And remember that Manic Panic hair dye back in the day? So I was like, I mean, and this was way after the grunge thing. I was just like, I hadn't seen it in so long, and it was all fucked up. And I was just like, oh wow, Manic Panic. And so I got I don't even remember. I bought a jar of the like clown red Manic Panic. I went back to my hotel, and I don't remember doing this. But you know, Millennium Hotels, they're all white. The
sure,
floors
okay.
are white, carpet's white, the walls are white, everything's white. I woke up in the morning laying on the floor, naked, stood up and saw red handprints, footprints all over the room, all over the walls, all over the, all over everything. And I was just like,
yeah, I don't think you used the hair dye right. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I was like, what the fuck? What's happened? Like, I thought it was blood. And I like go into the bathroom, and what I'd done was I'd evidently put the hair dye in and got high and knotted out and didn't rinse it out. So I'd passed out in the middle of the and you should have seen where my head was, because it was like this deep red that just radiated out. It looks like a Target footprints. Handprints all over the place.
I mean, that must have been some conversation when you then got fired from your own dad's band.
Well, at that point, I decided to, I was already living with two of the nastiest hookers in South Nashville, Tennessee, in a motel when I was off, so I didn't much care.
What year was that?
Been about 2000.
Okay, so then it took a while after that to get to your first album.
Yeah, yeah.
Like 8 years, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I almost made a record for... Fuck, what is that record called? Lost Highway, when I was 18 years old. It was right around the same time that all this shit happened. But actually, the same A&R person that signed me to New West, Kim Bowie, decided not to sign me to Lost Highway because I was too fucked up. She liked the songs, but it was like, we already got Ryan Adams. We don't need you.
It was, I think, 2011, you had like a relapse, a pretty dramatic one. Has it been fairly smooth for you in that time since, as smooth as can be, or what's the sobriety ride been like?
That's bumpy.
Yeah.
That is, you know, it's what I do for a living. But sobriety to me means I don't shoot heroin and cocaine together.
Right. You smoke weed, right?
A lot of weed.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, a lot.
What's your intake like? I mean, when you say a lot, like wake and bake, or are we talking?
Quarter ounce a day.
Uh-huh. Do you do edibles, or you just...
They're okay, but you just never know what you're getting.
Uh-huh.
I like Gorilla Glue. I think sticking with the Gorilla Glue, I like spliffs. Smoke the big cone spliffs, 15 to 18 of them a day.
That's a great deal of weed, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have anyone warning you that that's somehow bad for someone who has a history of addiction? Because there is some people who would think that.
No, I've never asked anybody a goddamn thing about that.
But you know, some people would be like, oh, that's, you know, that.
Oh, yes, of course they would. Yeah. Of course they would. My dad's one of them. He's like, wait, I was just like, you do you, I'll do me. You know, don't worry about it.
But you don't drink, or you do?
No.
Yeah. So that's pretty much... That's where you draw the line.
Yeah.
Fucking 4 pounds of weed a week.
That's yeah, I mean, it's like 2 ounces a week, basically.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Do you write high? Can you write high?
Yeah.
Yeah. Does it help you, you think?
I'm not sure if it does, but it's just one of those things when I sit and write, it's just like I smoke. Like, if I sit down to go, like, put things together, it just goes, it goes, it goes, it goes. I mean, I don't think that there's any substance that helps people write songs. I'm an ADHD kid, so, you know, a little speed focuses your brain up, but it doesn't mean that it helps you.
I think you said you were doing some non-songwriting, just some writing. I don't know if it was fiction or what, but what's the deal with that?
I'm still working on it. It's a book called Baseball, Blues, and LSD, Cultural Revolutions in America. I think that what would America be like if we'd never had baseball, never got the blues, and never had LSD.
I like that. So is that's an actual nonfiction research kind of thing, or just kind of?
Yeah, it's something I've been working on for a while, just slowly.
Were psychedelics ever part of your drug intake?
Well, actually, you know, I do take a lot of LSD.
You do?
Oh, fuck yeah.
Okay.
But I got real shit, Owsley acid, you know, real stuff, not some shit that you get from your cousin, you know. Nobody knows what that's like, you know. It's a very different thing.
It's hard to get nowadays, isn't it?
No. Well, it depends on who you know.
Yeah. I've had people say that they can't get it anymore, but
they must
be too old.
That's because they screwed up, you know. People are like, you know, my buddy who's a deadhead. It's like, no, I know actual deadheads, like real ones, not just some guy who bought a fucking tie-dyed shirt in 1982, like the guys who grew up with Owsley and all that stuff.
I mean, every baby boomer I've spoken to about their LSD experiences, and like every boomer has one, every creative boomer has one, but they're all like, I did it 12 times and it actually cracked open my creativity, but then one time I had the worst trip ever and then I never did it again. So, but you just keep going.
Well, I mean, and baby boomers are all proud of themselves because they're like, we went into the Vietnam War. It's like, well, yeah, you know what? And you screwed up the stock market in the 80s, didn't you? Because you turned right and went straight.
That is true.
Yep.
But what about, have you ever had a truly bad trip?
No. And not even when I was a kid and I took the bad shit. But that's the thing, is it's bad acid that gives you bad trips.
That's interesting. Do you kind of do a daily microdose? Or will,
No.
You don't believe in that. If you're dosing,
okay. I mean, well, you know, I like to, well, I'm not going to say how I carry it, but I always have it on me. And if I'm like, you know, you're delayed at the airport, just like, psh, peace out. Boom. I mean, you go.
Aren't you afraid of just, you know, fucking freaking out on the airplane? Or are you just so used to it at this point?
Once again, don't take bad acid.
Yeah. You got a strong physical and mental constitution, clearly.
Something like that.
I don't want to dwell too hard on this topic, but what do you get out of it? Out of like a Quinosity habit?
Well, you know, it's like, I don't take it and go out to the club. Out to the bar. It is a very spiritual thing. I don't want to give it to, you know, a bunch of guys and hang out and blah, you know, screw that. It's a very spiritual thing for me. I think it opens up the mind. I think that it allows the mind, you find the angles.
It's weird because your music is not conventionally psychedelic.
Fuck no, it's not. I'm not a fucking hippie. I mean, it's like, you know, you're not going to get no marshmallow chocolate covered overcoat from me. I mean, but that's the thing, is like, I don't, it's not to influence the music. That's for the head, I think. And, you know, tons of people will disagree with that. It's like, well, you had bad acid. Sorry.
Do you have any weakness for like the Dead, Fish, anything that this?
Fuck no. I do not like, never liked Fish. I never got into that shit. I was really good friends with John Perry Barlow, who wrote a lot of the Dead songs. I do like the Dead record, The Working Man's Dead.
Yeah, everybody likes that.
But the rest of it's like, I mean, a lot of it's just like wandering, spindly shit, you know, to me. And but I think Garcia was incredibly talented. I think Pigpen was incredibly talented, you know. I mean, some of the shit that Jerry Garcia did, his bluegrass stuff, was, it was awesome. Well, then John
Henry died. Tell me about your journey from, you've talked a lot of times about Nirvana Unplugged and the Lead Belly moment. But what was your journey to really digging into roots music from there? What were the kind of steps along the way, and what did you learn?
Well, it was actually that Unplugged record where I discovered who Lead Belly was. And it was an obsession with Lead Belly. I mean, a total obsession with Lead Belly that I then ended up from there discovering Woody Guthrie, then Dylan. And then went back to Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee, Son House. And I mean, this was like when I was 12, 13, you know, right around there.
Just a 12-year-old shooting heroin and listening to the blues.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's some crazy shit, man.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I was a shit. I mean, like I said, if I wasn't playing music, I'd be selling dope. And that's what I've always did before I started playing music.
So Sonny Terry McGee, and then where from there?
Oh, Sonny Terry, Barry McGee, then we got, you know, and I went through this real serious, like Emmett Miller comes up, Moon Mullican comes up. You just start getting into all this, starting really deep into the blues stuff.
And were you learning to play this stuff at that time, or did it take way longer to actually play it yourself on guitar and stuff?
I put the guitar pick down at that point and started playing with my fingers, and I didn't care about electric guitars. Started playing acoustic, and that's it. And it took, I think by the time I was 14, when I learned to play the So Different Blues by Vance Lipscomb.
Yeah, I wake up with the So Different Blues anytime.
That's a pretty complicated finger picking.
It's a pretty complicated, weird ragtime song.
Did you have anyone teaching you, or were you just kind of picking this stuff
up? My dad showed it to me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I was like, yeah, show this to me. He was like, you're not going to be able to do that. I was just like, just show it to me. Show it to me. And he showed me. And then I ended up getting this, what's the movie called? A Life Well Spent by this guy, or Well Spent Life. I can't remember, but it's a guy, Les Blank. He made these movie about Vance Lipscomb, Life Well Spent, and then The Blues According to Lightnin' Hopkins.
Mm.
I got both of those movies. And I was just upset. I had one of those TV combos with the VHS. Right. And I had the tapes, and I would just sit there and like rewind and just watch their fingers, you know, just play and try to learn it. I mean, just back and forth. I mean, I don't know what chords I'm playing. I don't ever know what key I'm in. I don't think Lightnin' Hopkins ever knew what key he was in.
I mean, and we're talking, this is the mid-90s, so this is like very little to do with anything that was going on in the larger culture. You were in your own kind of world, it feels like.
Well, I had that world, but, you know, it's like I'm white trash from Tennessee. If you're white trash, grew up in the 90s, I mean, you listen to punk rock, metal, and hip-hop. I listened to all that stuff. When I was away from my friends, I listened to all this stuff because they hated it.
The blue stuff, the roots.
Oh, what is that shit? My buddy Carlos Miller says, he was like, what is that honky shit you're listening to? I said, dude, that's Lightning Hopkins. I was like, he ain't no honky.
Did you learn to play 90s rock and all that shit too? Can you rock out a Sublime song if you want? If you need to.
Not a Sublime song, but I can play some, a lot of Nirvana. I can play a lot of Sleater-Kinney and things like that. I was in a band, I can't even remember what me and my cousin called it, but my cousin is a great drummer. He was in a band called, later became a hardcore drummer. He was a band called Evergreen Terrace out of Florida. We were a great hardcore drummer, but when we were kids, we had a punk rock band and it was messy. It was messy.
Do you ever get the private urge to write stuff in that kind of vein ever?
No. It takes a different kind of energy, you know. I mean, I know Mike Ness very well. And, you know, he has to go in the back of his truck that carries all his gear. When they empty it, they set up a boxing rig in it. He has a speed bag. He has a heavy bag. The mats are all down. He bands his feet together, and he goes in there and just goes for it for hours before the show. I think that you have to do that to keep playing punk rock, or otherwise you'd kill somebody.
Jesus. But yeah, I mean, I could see you could very easily, in a slightly shifted over world, be fronting a band like Social Distortion. I don't think that's so crazy.
You know, it's like, it's funny. It's like, I could see it, but I'm more interested in, like, you know, it's like, I want to make a jazz record. I want to do a record with the Preservation Hall Band. Justin Townes Earl sings the best of Billie Holiday with the Preservation Hall Band.
Oh, dude, do that. That sounds fantastic.
Yeah, we just got to talk the record label into paying for it.
Yeah.
And them into doing it.
Have you seen them a bunch of times in Preservation Hall? There's something about that.
I've played with them a few times. And
oh, wow. Okay.
I know Ben Jaffe pretty good. And I've seen them at Preservation Hall, and I've seen them out at the chapel in San Francisco, too. And it's a special thing.
There's something almost holy about seeing them in the hall without the amplification and stuff.
Absolutely.
It's one of the most incredible musical experiences I've probably ever had.
It's insane. It is. It's incredible.
So, Justin Townes Earl, man, thanks a lot. That was a lot of fun. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So this has been today's Rolling Stone Music Now. Check out Justin's new album, The Saint of Lost Causes.
Saint of Lost Causes.
And we'll be back next week here on Sirius XM's Volume, Channel 106. In the meantime, we are a podcast. Download us as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Maybe leave us a nice review on iTunes. And as always, thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.